hosts, Maya Monell and Aaron Papworth, founders of the Navit Money app, the money management app that uses behavioral science to foster financial wellness. On this episode of the Navit podcast, Aaron and I sat down with David Stacey, co-CEO and founder of Young Alfred. Together with his team, David is working to put insurance in the hands of the customer. David takes us through the world of insurance, how to explore your options, and why the world of insurance is ripe for innovation. Enjoy the episode. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the Navit podcast. We're joined today by David Stacey. David, welcome so much to the show. It's wonderful to have you on, and I can't wait to dive in.
Yeah, thank you. Excited to be here and excited to explore the world of insurance today.
So exciting.
There's so much to get involved in. We promise not to bore you all in the world of insurance. And really, I think that's David and Young Alfred's role, is to make insurance more compelling, more acceptable, more exciting to a lot of our listeners. And we share an audience, so we're really excited about this. David, let's dive right in. And I'd love you to have a chance to give the audience an overview of your background and really how you found yourself founding Young Alfred.
Yeah, happy to. I never thought I'd end up in the insurance world. Actually got my start in finance, doing investment banking for a couple of years, then moved on to private equity. And, you know, those jobs are generally like glorified in the media, but when you're actually working them, they're not as fun. And
were you bored, David?
Not bored, but
Burned out. There we go.
Yeah. Learned a ton and great industries and early career paths, in my opinion, but made the decision to go to business school to kind of explore different opportunities and really wanted to give entrepreneurship a real shot, and ended up at Wharton Business School, where I met my co-founder, Jason. Lucky we got connected very early in school, met like the second day. Lived in the same building, same classes, and he had come from the hedge fund and high frequency trading world. And we both kind of thought about our experience moving and switching insurance and finding it. And that was kind of like the initial spark to dive deeper into the industry. And, you know, back in 2015, 2016, when we were thinking about what we wanted to build, we would have thought, you know, an Expedia or Kayak model for insurance already existed. But the deeper we dug, the more we found online was just a bunch of lead gen, and the buying experience was very much still offline. So what we set out to build was a marketplace where consumers can go online, fill out one form, shop with all the options available to them, and buy all completely digitally. Make it very transparent, easy to understand what you're buying, and, you know, importantly, not get harassed in the experience with insurance agents trying to sell you or cold call you. And so fast forward today, we're a digital marketplace selling primarily home insurance. We do auto, flood, earthquake, all personal lines in all 50 states, and we're working with about 40 different insurance carriers.
When did you found Young Alfred? And frankly, can I ask what's behind the name?
Yes, great question. So what's behind the name? We wanted to break away from like any version of insurance this or coverage that, and really create more of a personality around the product. And so we ended up with Young Alfred. It was a cheap domain name to buy at the time, and we were broke business school students, but also a play on Batman's butler, Alfred, who watches over and protects his assets. And so, bit of Batman behind the story of the name.
Makes total sense.
Batman should be behind every founder story. Yes. Maybe we're more like Wonder Woman, but we totally resonate.
Yeah.
We're on the same team.
Yeah, exactly.
I think it's impressive that you got 40 insurance companies to be on your marketplace now. That's no small lift. I'm sure we're going to get into this, but let's go back to how you did that.
Yeah, a lot of persistence. And, you know, you asked when we actually started this. It was late 2015, which, you know, 5 years ago now. We started calling on carriers. We're like, hey, you know, we have no insurance experience, but we're smart guys, right? We're in business school. Here's a pitch deck. Like, this is what we're going to do. We're going to bring you a bunch of customers. And no one would return our emails, like, listen to us. And so we ended up having to get a lot of partnerships. It took about 2 years to get just a handful stood up. And in some cases, we were like working with the local marketing rep for a national carrier. So just Pennsylvania, they thought we were a regular insurance agency, didn't really have any idea what we were actually doing. And over the last 3 years, we've grown pretty substantially with all our carriers. So, you know, we moved to national accounts and get more carriers on the platform. And, you know, now we're working with a lot of the big names you would recognize, like Progressive, Travelers, Nationwide. And also importantly, a lot of single state carriers or regional carriers that you probably haven't heard of, but they have really good product and pricing in, you know, in a couple states. And they win a lot of business. So, you know, the big guys spend a lot on branding and you know them and they're great options, but I wouldn't overlook a lot of these smaller carriers.
That's great. And we're definitely going to dive in. And I really want to get into that of kind of deconstructing the world of insurance. And first and foremost, we all know that insurance is probably a great thing to have. But what are some of those serious events that good insurance can make a lot less painful? And frankly, you know, what should we all be covered for?
Yeah, that's a great question. And so insurance is regulated in every state and it's rather consistent state to state. So there are baseline forms that all the carriers are operating on. And I guess what I would touch on here is, you know, a couple things that aren't necessarily always included in a policy that you want to double check because they are the nice to have. One is if you're buying a traditional kind of like homeowner's policy, the value of the home should be replaced at replacement cost and not actual cash value. Nearly all on the market are at replacement cost, but I would always confirm that because the last thing you want is cost $400,000 to rebuild your home, but they're saying it was depreciated to $100,000. Then you're out $300,000. Mm-hmm. Second is a common add-on called personal property replacement costs. Mm-hmm. And this comes back to replacing all your personal belongings at the cost to buy them new rather mm-hmm. than, you know, getting a check for 10 cents on the dollar. So the TV you have that is working just fine for you, if you need to buy a new one, it might cost you $500. But if you don't have personal property replacement costs, the insurance carrier may say you couldn't have sold that for more than $50. So that's all we'll pay.
So sorry, just to be clear, as a homeowner, I was just looking at my policy. So if I don't have that personal replacement cost, I still get some coverage if in case of a fire, but not at the actual value of the item. So I needed that supplemental piece to get like a proper one-for-one kind of return.
Yeah, so you can be made whole and go buy the product again at the cost of buying new.
Yeah. I'm interested, so sorry, going back to the replacement cost versus cash value. What I've always seen is it's never the like actual value. Like I've always, every time I've seen, you know, people give an offer, it's significantly lower than what the market value says it is, like on Zillow or on, you know, Redfin or whatever. So do you negotiate that? Is that something you can fight?
Yeah, so this is an important point to the first kind of thing to pay attention to is A, make sure your home is insured at replacement costs. And then also getting that estimate accurate is important. And you can see a lot of times with older homes, there may be a pretty wide variance on the price to rebuild the home new versus the market value, because the market value can swing based on how hot the housing market is, what's going on in the neighborhood. But the cost of rebuild is really construction and materials. Right. And mm-hmm. so sometimes you wind up having to pay for insurance that says, you know, we're going to insure up to $400,000, even though you bought a $200,000 home. Better to have that full coverage at $400,000. It might cost you a little bit more, but you will get penalized if you don't have it insured at full replacement cost when a claim comes.
Well, and that's super important, especially as, you know, we are recording this in the age of COVID and people are moving out of cities and into suburban or, you know, rural areas that are seeing a boom. I mean, I live in one of them and our property has like tripled in value in the last 7 months. So, you know, I think that that's a really important thing to measure when, especially you're making these moves to maybe buy a home in a more affordable area. So are other people.
Yeah. And not to beat a dead horse, but how do you make sure that that estimate is accurate? Like, do you contact them and say, hey, you guys are underbidding me here?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a really good question as well. So one, when you go to get quotes at insurance carriers, they all have their own internal calculators. Yeah. And if you check a number of options, you're going to get a range and it's usually reasonably tight. And they err on the conservative side. Yeah. So you may find it a little bit higher than you would like generally. And if you think it is too high, you can always ask your agent or carrier to, you know, what can you change to reduce that value? But you're also, I would be comfortable with the value, comparing the value the carriers are providing and look at kind of like an average of that. And then what's the appraisal say? Because usually the appraisals are going to have a rebuild cost there. And yeah, just make sure you're not way under on the, mm-hmm, I guess, the total coverage.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I guess property tax, like in this, mine is actually inverse. Like, I'm in a hot market, even though COVID is changing, whatever. So the coverage that I've gotten is about 3/4 of what the market value is. It's roughly about what I paid for it now that the price has gone up. So this is really good to know. I'm going to go talk to my people.
Yes.
And that's really why we had you on today.
This is why. Thank you. You solved all my financial problems, David.
So you did actually spark one, I guess, comment based on that and the difference, like certain markets, there may be consistent large differences on the cost to rebuild versus the market value. California is one of them. You know, mm-hmm, people are buying $3 million homes and cost $800,000 to rebuild. So,
okay.
Those are the harder ones to actually get right.
Okay, good. I feel a little bit better.
So, you know, I have to ask this. What are some of the biggest barriers consumers do face when buying home insurance?
Yeah, I think it's usually a bit of an afterthought when you're going through at least a home closing, and it's just something you have to get right to close the mortgage, close on your new home. And so there's usually about three paths consumers will take to find their insurance. One is they contact their existing insurance agent. They might already have auto insurance with them. And, you know, they say, hey, can you give me home insurance? They don't think much about it, requires a phone call. They give them the info, the price, the home, and they just stick with the same carrier agent they currently have. Second is doing a bit of shopping the traditional way. Maybe you get a referral to an agent. It's hard to find good insurance agents if you don't have contacts with them. And again, this process is very offline, all over the phone. Third, and we're seeing more and more of this, consumers going online to start. There's just major traps going online right now where you search, you know, best home insurance, and then you get 10 sites saying free 10 quick quotes in 50 seconds or whatever. You give them your name, your email, your phone number.
Oh, no.
And by the time you entered that, your phone's already ringing because your info just got sold off to a bunch of different companies.
Yeah.
So when you go online, unless you're checking carriers direct, and calling them, you just got to be careful about falling for a lot of these marketing traps that are promising an end-to-end buying experience, but they want your info, and then they're selling it off to the people who can actually sell you a policy.
What's also fascinated me about the insurance world, and as I was doing some prep for this podcast, David, was the fact that they have so much human capital. Like, they have such great overhead expense, right? And in a world, again, ridden by COVID, but also with this extreme opportunity to automate a lot of this process and make the experience more inbound, like, is this why insurance is often so expensive and really egregiously so now?
Yeah, pricing and insurance could do a whole nother podcast on that in and of itself, but they do. So overhead costs, there's a lot of personnel to run an insurance company because really all the technology was built 50 years ago, and that's what a lot of people are still operating on. Advertising continues to become a larger and larger percentage of an insurance carrier's budget. So Geico, State Farm, Allstate, Progressive, they all spend over $1 billion a year in ads. And at the end of the day, who's ultimately eating that cost? It is the consumer. And pair that with a little bit of increased, natural disaster activity. Home insurance premiums have gradually been rising year over year for the last decade or so.
Okay, I'm going to sidebar for a second, but I just listened to a really interesting another podcast. Everyone should listen to ours and this one. But it's about the reality that these counties and air environments in California that are consistently now being hit by these wildfires. There was a state mandate that came in a year ago, right? You can tell me more about this, David. That insurance carriers were dropping these counties and people couldn't get home insurance. So the state came in and mandated that they have to, but only for the next 12 months. Like, after that, it's kind of anyone's guess if people are going to be able to insure their homes in these areas that keep getting hit. And which I'm sure is probably true in the Gulf Coast too, with, the hurricanes. And so I'm really interested in what you see happening with these rise in natural disasters. And does it have to be government regulated? Or do they need to not build in these areas that are so vulnerable, et cetera?
Yes, that's a hot topic in the insurance world for sure. And I think we're seeing a number of different things. And California, namely, the wildfire risk has become so problematic in the last 5 years that if your home is close to brush fire or any of the maps that the carriers use to identify fire line, no insurance carriers will quote you. And it's just like binary. You're either eligible for everyone or no one. And we're seeing really a lot of those homes have to be put on a state plan called California Fair Plan, which is ultimately backed by the insurance carrier, so they're still having to pay for it, but
it's reinsured by them.
It's a mix of the states need to make the environment friendly enough for carriers to be willing to go there and actually underwrite and do business and still try and control for fair pricing and good options for consumers. And it's a balance where some of these markets, you almost get to the point where they're uninsurable because you can look at earthquake and flood as other products that really the government had to step in and create FEMA flood plans to insure a lot of these homes that are built in high risk zones. And then the last piece, yes, building codes, how homes are built and all the requirements that go into that do really affect the insurance markets, because if in some states where homes generally aren't up to code and you have that natural disaster exposure, the insurance carriers just they can't make any profit whatsoever in those areas, so they're not going to touch it and it's going to fall back on the government. It's tricky,
and ultimately us, the taxpayer.
Yes. Yay. You're paying for it one way or another.
One way or another, you're screwed, basically, David. That's what you're telling me.
God. Yeah. And you know, there's a nasty, I mean, coming from California, and certainly a lot of my friends and family are still there. There's a nasty rumor. And actually, David, maybe you'll tell me that it's true, but that in a lot of these areas that are burning right now, the insurance providers are saying that they will not provide you with coverage, even if you've paid for it to date, if you choose to rebuild in the same spot.
Ooh, that's interesting. I haven't heard that one yet.
I mean, it might be hearsay, but I mean, do you think that that's too out of the realm, or do you think that that's actually kind of where they're headed?
Well, the contract you're signing with the carrier would legally obligate them to have to pay. I guess there is the one piece to dig into is, will they continue to insure your home after it is rebuilt?
Yeah.
Right.
And
that's a good point.
And they wouldn't be able to drop you on that.
That's a good point.
I think that was part of the mandate from the state that they had to. I mean, that could potentially be up very soon.
So interesting. Well, okay. I don't want to go down the road of doom and gloom on this podcast, David, because we're really enjoying the conversation. So, you know, more optimistically, I think, how do you foresee the industry having to evolve, maybe based on a lot of these environmental factors as well as the evolution of technology?
Yeah. So I think one is more sophisticated pricing and the more data that is coming out, and this is something the carriers have to be very careful with too, because if you throw data into a black box, you might find outputs that, you know, are really unfair to certain segments of the population or where you live. But being able to more accurately price risk based on profiles of homes and consumers, and, you know, right now that's generally, most carriers relying on a similar data set to say this home is in this fire line score. If you can take that to the next level and go, all these homes actually don't have that level of fire exposure that we thought, because we have more data on the surrounding forest and brush, and it's really not the same exposure that we thought. So now all these homes are actually eligible. That would open up some stuff in the market. I think the biggest transformation that is underway is just digitization of the tech stack across the industry. And that's not only front-end consumer facing technology, like making forms easier, more intuitive, but a lot of the back end, what these policies are being stored on, what the actual insurance agents are using, and the amount of cost that carriers have from a personnel standpoint, because they're doing very manual processes, is getting automated. And the automation is picking up quite a bit now. That InsurTech has put a lot of pressure on the incumbents to significantly invest in new technology and take the InsurTech serious.
I mean, that's exciting. In the long, I mean, while natural disasters are creating a bloat of the cost, at least technology has the ability to hopefully drive some of the cost down.
It will take time, but yeah. Yes.
I mean, that's not an industry that's going to change quickly. It's like, you're going to have a couple decades.
No, it's just like finance, which David knows well. So,
right.
Yes.
The incumbents are hesitant to make any move that's deviating from the status quo.
Right. And I feel like the amount of risk involved, which is the same with finances, right? The risk to these industries is so high that you're going to have to find that balance between what technology can advance for them and how you could de-risk the whole situation before they make any real moves. Actually, on that note, what have you seen other than what you guys are doing? This is a great one. And what I understand you're doing is much more, it's revolutionary for the consumer, right? You're making the consumer choice better, which is so exciting. And we are so happy to partner with you. But do you see long-term, like there's tech stacks and things that are coming through with InsurTech that's making the overall system better, both for the consumer and for the insurance?
Yes. That's happening on a number of fronts. one on the insurtech side, kind of like the Lemonade model or Hippo insurance model that is more full stack. They've been able to build really their technology from the ground up, and that's been a huge advantage to create really good consumer experiences. But at the same time, that has put the right pressure on the major players to rethink the technology that they're using and their agents are using. And, you know, Nationwide just, I think, spent $300 million on a new personalized rating platform for their insurance agents. And so it's a really heavy lift for them to get off some of the legacy technology, but carriers are re-looking at their applications and their underwriting and going, do we really have to ask this question? Because some of these insurance questions were built 100 years ago, and they're asking about, like, you know, China and fur coats and stuff that consumers just, like, really don't have much anymore, but carriers still have it as questions on their app. So it is creating quicker, easier experiences. And also, you know, once you buy with a carrier, you can engage with them via an app or chat and not rely on a bunch of things coming in the mail.
Totally. I, like Aaron said, I mean, we're so excited, honored to partner with you all, and we're really excited for what you're providing to the consumer. And so I want to, before we get into our concluding round of questions, I want to give you kind of more say into what you all are doing at Young Alfred, and, you know, really define what your vision is and how you think what your product is doing will influence the broader industry.
Yeah, appreciate that. So really, the core of our vision is to power the future of all home insurance shopping. And the way, you know, we want Young Alfred to be synonymous with home insurance, kind of the way Starbucks is with coffee, right? But it's more than just consumers coming to our main website and shopping with us because, you know, they found us via referral or online, but also powering that shopping experience in other environments. So you can imagine you're closing on your home, you're on your lender's website, and it has an option to get home insurance. And you go through, fill out an app on their site, and you buy, and you think you bought from your lender, but really behind the scenes, it was Young Alfred technology powering that. So it's leveraging a lot of the infrastructure we built into all the different carriers, automating the quoting, automating the buying, making it very easy and transparent, and then allowing other partners to build on top of our technology.
That's awesome. And it really is a better experience. I mean, everything about it, I've just been going through it and your specific site, and it tells you what you need. Like, you've done a great job making it customer focused, right? Because I know I'm in Seattle, so I know I need earthquake insurance. But do I need mold insurance? You told me I did. I mean, I kind of knew that, but not, that wouldn't be the first thing I asked, you know? And so you're like giving the information that the user needs at the same time. And then you're like nice about it. Like, do you have a kid? I'm like, oh yeah, I have a kid. Oh, they grow up too fast. I'm like, oh shucks, you're right.
Or are you?
Yeah. So it's like, so, you know, in the end, I think being user focused in an environment that's already scary and fear evoking and so costly, and giving them the right information is something that in the long run insurance needs to get better at, and you guys are setting the precedent for.
Yeah, I appreciate that, and we are customer obsessed. I know a lot of companies say that, but in insurance, we feel you really have to be able to drive that five-star experience. And for the few clients that we've tripped up and we've made a mistake, I can even think of one that happened earlier this year. We made a full webinar for the team to unpack what happened with this client and where we went wrong and what we could do better the next time around. Yeah. And that's kind of like core to our ethos is customer first, and you have to be customer obsessed to really, I think, you know, change the experience in an industry that generally has pretty low NPS scores.
Yeah. Yeah. So you say your bar is low?
We don't know anything about that, Aaron.
Only go up from here.
Yeah,
exactly. Well, I love it. Well, David, once again, thank you so much for walking us through the very interesting and frankly exciting new world of insurance. Of course, we want to end with our rapid fire questions. So the first one to start out is, what money stereotypes do you think society have to overcome?
So the one thing that really pops into my head is consumers need to understand how to use debt. And yes, for the most part, it's avoided. And I'm also talking about student loans. You have to be very careful taking on any sort of consumer debt, car loans, et cetera. But the student loan bubble, so to speak, continues to get larger, and you see more education, universities out there promising, you know, almost like selling false dreams to people. Mm-hmm. And you take out a loan for $40,000, you get your degree, but what does your degree really get you? It's much more about get the right skills. And today, in today's age, you can go on Coursera and all these other online classes and really learn the skills that are going to have a much higher ROI for you for a much longer period of time than just doing what has been the default for most people growing up, and that's take out student loans, go to school, get a degree, and then just assume you're going to get a good job out of it.
I love that. And that's coming from an MBA as well.
Maybe it's from
and you and I can talk about offline, because I mean, I went to business school too, and you know, there's definitely a place for it, but it's an interesting world in which we live in. So of course at Navit, we're centered around financial well-being. So we have to ask the second question. How do you define a healthy money mindset?
It's a good question. What comes to my mind in the way I tend to think about money comes back to time and how you spend your time. So one is, if you're being productive with your time, generally you can be making money and also increasing your earning power by learning new skills. I personally believe it's much easier to increase earning power rather than focus exclusively on savings. And your bank account will build over time at a faster rate with higher earning power, rather than, you know, only focusing on, you know, not buying the Starbucks coffee every day. And back to time as well, and money, I'm a finance background by trade. I think of the power of compounding interest and being able to save at an early age. The numbers just stack over time because you get the value of the interest payments over a number of years. So not putting off being responsible with your money until you deem yourself an adult, which today can be, you know, mid to late 30s. It's just always better to get started early.
I love this. I love that so much. And one of the things we worked with the CFP early on at Navit to try and, like, you know, organize the product. And one of the things he loved to say, which I totally agree with, and it's kind of baked into our product, is, you know, in terms of your income to expense ratio, you have two options. Either you spend less or you make more. I mean, like, and it sounds better to make more, right? And like, try and keep your expenses reasonable, but why not have more of an abundance mindset, which versus the scarcity of like save, you know, constriction versus growth, essentially. So I love it.
And I think that's so great, coupling your skill set and the evolution of your skill set over time too means hopefully you're also making more money.
Yeah.
So lastly, when was the last time you financially nabbed something, and how did you do it?
Definitely starting young Alfred. Quit my cushy job in finance to go spend a bunch of money on business school tuition, and then dumped personal money into starting Young Alfred. And so, I mean, myself and my co-founder Jason went 3 years without a paycheck. Our hack was being married to lovely wives that were paying all the bills.
Shout
and
out
supporting
to the women.
Us. Yes.
Oh my God.
I don't know how I would have done it without that, but yeah, having a supportive partner to help, you know, foot when times get a little bit tight is huge. And so mm-hmm. we had to live a lot more frugally, and we were also working 100 hours a week anyway. So we weren't having, you know, fun at the restaurants and bars and spending a bunch of money. So it was like kind of forced frugality. But it was a significant change to go from, a nice finance job to emptying your bank account and then some, and then no paycheck for 3 years.
That takes you both
are like the male versions of Aaron and I think we would talk exactly.
And having that financial partner is like real. Every entrepreneur I know, other than people that maybe came from, you know, different kinds of wealth, that have had some financial partner that has supported them in the chaos of those early years and the pain and suffering that we all must master.
Especially in tech, because let's just be honest, most of us are young dreamers that have a vision for evolving or shaking up an industry that really needs to change. So we commend you, David, for your work at Young Alfred and your resilience. I think that those
and shout out to your wife.
Yeah, I'll shout out to her.
Well, thank you, David, so much for joining Aaron and I for this episode of the Navit podcast. We're so excited to launch this with our audience. And frankly, we look forward to having you back soon.
We can talk about investment pricing. What about where to find them?
I was going to say, the last thing is, we'd love to give our audience a place to find you and Young Alfred to get them signed up as well.
Yes. So our website, youngalfred.com, best place to find us. We have chat functionality. You can always call us. But also we are on some socials, The Young Alfred on Facebook and Twitter.
Perfect. We will add those to the show notes. Thanks so much, David, for joining us.
Thanks, Maya. Thanks, Aaron. Really enjoyed it.
Bye, David. Thanks.
Bye.
I hope you've enjoyed this episode. Care to continue the convo? You can connect with fellow navigators in the app or on our Let's Navit Facebook page. Oh, and be sure to get social with us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at Let's Navit. That's LetsNavit. And finally, wherever you're listening to this podcast, it would really help us if you would take a minute to rate, review, and subscribe. That's it for today's episode. Until next time,
let's navigate!